From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
There's a new book on my bookshelf that I really enjoyed. The book is called Starring Joan Crawford, The Films, The Fantasy, and the Modern Relevance of a Silver Screen Icon. And the author, Samuel Garza Bernstein, is my guest. He's a screenwriter and a playwright, and he's here to talk Joan Crawford with us. Samuel Garza Bernstein, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
That's an unusual combination of names.
It is. I took the, my mother was Mexican, and her maiden name was Garza. And so that became part of my last name, actually, officially, just a few years ago, because I learned some interesting information about her background and wanted to honor her.
Well, it's very nice. Is she still living?
No. She died very young. She died when she was 49.
Wow, that's a lot. That's terrible. Sorry to hear that. And that's cool. I mean, it's a good moniker that definitely gets people's attention, doesn't it? So your book, starring Joan Crawford, it's not like other Joan Crawford books, and I think that's mostly because of the fantasy part. So you came up with some interesting ideas about how Joan Crawford would fit into today's movie world, I guess we would say.
Well, I really wanted to talk about how she's relevant now. And one of the ways I can do that is by imagining her in, you know, if she were in her 20s, who would she be? Or her 30s or 40s, 50s, 60s. And, you know, she started out as the it girl and influencer in the 1920s. And, you know, she wore a dress in 1932 in a movie, and a million women all over the world wore copies of that dress. So I imagine her, if she were 20 years old today, as Barbie. You know, she would have been the Barbie girl. And you know, different ages, she'd be different iconic women of our own era.
I like that Joan Crawford, Clark Gable team up in Doctor Strange.
Yes. Well, my favorite thing is that it's Doctor Strange, but Joan still gets first
top billing.
Yes.
Well, I'm a huge fan of Joan Crawford's, and I always have been. And I remember when she was still alive and well and making films and television appearances. I think, you know, some of her latter day things people had a less of an opinion of, but I mean, some of the things she did on television, for instance, were great. Like she did that. I think Steven Spielberg directed her I think it was the
Night
pilot.
Gallery.
Night Gallery. Yeah. That's a great little piece.
It is. It really is. And it was actually Steven Spielberg's first job. And he remembered her being very wary of this very, very young director. But once she agreed to it, she showed up on set and told everyone how much she trusted him and that they'd worked together before, which wasn't quite true. But she wanted the crew to really respond to him as being in charge. And he was 23 or something. And he remembered that as being just really the most generous thing in the world, because the crew hated him. You know, they were all like, you know, 40, 50-year-old lifers, you know, and here's this 23-year-old telling them what to do. Well, the star of the show said, yeah, this guy's great. You should trust him. And they did.
Yeah, and the film came out great. So,
yeah.
What more can you ask for? You know, I had a, because I was a kid, I thought of Joan Crawford as old when she died, but she wasn't very old.
Well, depending upon
depending
upon what her birth year was, because there's a wide range of possibilities, but we think it is most likely that it was 1906. So she was, she would have been, oh my gosh, my math is eluding me, 71 when she died. And, you know, that's not very old.
Especially today. I mean, lots of actresses are still working. But in her day, very few actresses who started working in 1927 were still working in 1967.
Yes.
That's the, sort of the magic of Joan Crawford, is she continuously reinvented herself. Can you talk a little bit about the phases of her career?
Well, in the beginning, when she was this jazz baby full of, you know, joyful youth and dancing, and, you know, she was the flapper. I call that her influencer and it girl period. She was just she was the most famous girl in the world for a while. And but then as she became sort of queen of the MGM movies, I say she was queen of the movies. She did rom-coms like you wouldn't believe. And we don't even think of her that way. But she was, you know, she was always in all of these movies where it was like, oh, my gosh, is she going to choose Clark Gable or is she going to choose Robert Montgomery? I don't know. Yeah, she always chose Clark Gable. there was never any doubt about that. And then 20 years after her start in movies, when she left MGM and went over to Warner Brothers, she really had the comeback of all comebacks. 1945, when she went over to Warner Brothers and made Mildred Pierce and started playing these kind of mothers and martyrs and these film noir women. And it was really a major, major reinvention. And then in the 50s, she started doing these dragon lady parts in movies like Queen Bee and Harriet Craig. And I mean, she was just, you know, sort of dementedly evil sometimes in these movies. And then, of course, in the 60s, she started with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane as this kind of survivor, and doing these movies that were sort of more thrillers or even schlocky horror movies. But they all did business. You know, her last feature film was a movie called Trog, which is just dreadful. I mean, she plays in quotation marks, a lady scientist, you know, and, you know, not just a scientist.
Can you imagine that? Yeah. Right?
who discovers a troglodyte, like the missing link, which is this pasty white guy with no hair on any part of his body except for this weird ape mask. And it's just dreadful. It opened at number one at the box office in America. Number one.
That's,
you know, and which I was shocked. Because I've seen the movie, I knew about the movie, but I did all this research when I was working on the book, and I'm looking at all of these things, and I'm like, are you kidding me? There it is, right there in Variety, number one for the week when it opened.
Well, you know, a lot of young people, and when I say young people, I include my guest Samuel Garza Bernstein, don't like older movies. They don't like black and white movies. They don't like movies from the golden age, or they've never even seen them, or they don't bother with them. How did you become a golden age movie fan?
Well, I'm not as young as you might imagine, but I moved to New York in the early 80s when I was 17, and I started working for Douglas Fairbanks Jr. And he was writing his memoirs at the time. I mean, I'd always been a fan of old movies and things, but he was writing his memoirs. And of course, Joan Crawford was his first wife.
Right.
And this was maybe 6-7 years after the publication of Mommy Dearest. And he was very forthright about saying that was not, you know, a portrait of the woman that he knew, or the woman that he stayed in contact with until her death. I mean, they sent each other flowers and gifts and things for the rest of her life, even though they divorced, I think, in 1933. And I was curious about who that woman was, you know, and I went to see her old movies and to see Our Dancing Daughters, which was her sort of Barbie. It was her breakout hit of 1928. And to see this kind of joy and excitement and really a modern performance, even though it's this silent movie, it really it kind of whets your appetite to understand more about, well, what, how did this business, how did this art form begin, and how has it progressed? And one of the things that I find fascinating is that you sometimes look at people from that era and you say, okay, that would be, this person would be a star right now. And I think Joan Crawford is like that. Other times you look at people and you just go, what? You don't get it at all.
Yeah.
I feel that way about Joan Crawford's biggest rival at MGM in her glory years, which is Norma Shearer. And I know Miss Shearer has her fans out there, but to me, I just look at her work and I go, I don't get it. Like, I just,
you
know,
you mentioned one of Norma Shearer's films that I think is her best performance on film. And now I suddenly can't remember the title of the picture, but it's the one where she plays twins who have been separated and they're from an orphanage. And that particular picture, Norma Shearer is very contemporary. Her acting is, I mean, I think you watch that movie and you go, oh, that could be now.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you about that. And also in, she won an Oscar for a movie called A Free Soul, I think it was. I'm sorry. The Divorcee.
The Divorcee, yes.
Divorcee. That's what she was around for. And she was very modern, but she...
She's in A Free Soul as well.
Yeah, that's right. But she sort of developed this kind of veneer of, like, great lady falseness that, you know, well, I guess you're around for long enough, you kind of fancy yourself a great lady, I guess. But yeah. I do. I fancy myself a great lady.
So. Well, you know, Norma Shearer, her career kind of had the natural span of an actress in those days, you know, and when she was, I think by the time she was 40, she was retired and never made another movie. But, you know,
Joan went on and she went on as a star, the people that really had the long, long, long careers. If you talk about somebody like Gladys Cooper, they were never, I mean, they were a star in their youngest days in the theater, perhaps, but then they played character roles and they survived for 50 years playing character roles.
Mary Astor
never
would be
played
another
a character
example.
Role.
Yeah, that's
she was the leading lady. That was it.
Yeah. Well, but now you mentioned this movie that I love, the Dancing Daughters. And I think if people watch this movie today, you know, like when stage diving was a big thing in the 80s, she does this stage dive right off the, she just like throws her body into the crowd. With
yeah.
All,
I mean, she's in a mosh pit. She's in a like 1928 mosh pit.
And, yeah. And she does the Charleston. I mean, a lot of people make fun of her dancing because it's clunky. But you point out that her clunky dancing was actually like in style. I mean,
yeah. That clunkiness was part of what made the Charleston and the Black Bottom and all of those things. That's what made them kind of, you know, drunken fun, that you were kind of lurching around, you know, and it was kind of, they didn't want it to be all beautiful and you know, elegant. The idea was it to be a little down and dirty. And so, I mean, it really was kind of the twerking of its generation. And, you know, I don't think anybody would look at twerking and say, wow, that's elegant.
I heard Charleston is a lot more elegant than Miley Cyrus's twerking.
Well, I would agree with you there.
Yeah, I think if Joan Crawford can look back at her twerking, I mean, at her Charleston and be proud of it, where Miley will look back on her twerking and wonder what she was thinking.
Well, actually, and you know, I mean, this is off the subject, but Miley is. I mean, she's looking at herself naked on that wrecking ball going, you know, that's embarrassing, and I'm sorry.
And it was only 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, this is nice. Here's one of my favorites, and I know you all like her too, because she's the personification of youth and beauty and joy and happiness, Joan Crawford.
That's awfully kind of you, Conrad. Thank you.
I think Joan has a surprise for you.
All day I talk about you. All night I think about you. I just want to be someone you want to see. Why, you've got me walking on air. I only hope that you care. I'd be satisfied just to hang around you. Crazy about your smile, free and easy style. You're a loving child, got a feeling for you. Ooh, I like your turned up nose. I like your seasoned velvet suit. From your head to toe, got a feeling for you. No one but you. Did you ever see somebody who could love somebody much as I love you, huh? Did you? You're the kind of sweet somebody who could love somebody. How about me too, huh? Oh my, you're one night crave. I could be your slave. Honey, let me rave. Got a feeling for you. Crazy about your smile. Free and easy style.
That was Miss Joan Crawford from her very first talking picture, The Hollywood Review of 1929. And we are talking with Samuel Garza Bernstein. He's the author of Starring Joan Crawford, The Films, The Fantasy, and The Modern Relevance of a Silver Screen Icon. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf.
So I was going to ask you to sort of pick your favorites from each of these eras. I have my favorites, of course, but I want to know yours too. I mean, I know that you and I disagree on Grand Hotel. I love Grand Hotel. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And I just think it's great.
I mean, I
don't find it corny or dated in any way.
I think it's a wonderful example of what stardom was about in that era. And I think that Joan is the most alive thing in that whole bunch of stars. She seems modern. She seems alive. She seems connected to like what's actually happening. For me, Garbo and John Barrymore and Lionel Barrymore and, you know, they were all bigger stars in their, you know, in a way at the time. And certainly Garbo was thought of as much more important than Joan Crawford. But I don't think it's among Garbo's best performances. And I think it is among Joan's best performances.
Absolutely. She makes the movie. There's so many scenes. And if people haven't seen Grand Hotel, you can join the argument by seeing it right now. It's really good. Not right now, but when we're done talking. But I think it's a really interesting movie because if young people see it today, and I do sometimes show it to my film appreciation class, they don't know that those people were all stars. That was kind of the theme of the picture, is that everybody in it, from the smallest porter played by Gene Herschel to Louis Stone, everybody is a movie star. But if you don't know that they're movie stars, then they're just actors. You know, like if you watch it now and you're not familiar with any of them, and most people are not familiar with all
of
those stuff.
I think that's true, but I think it's not true. I think they don't know specifically you know, they don't know specifically that's John Barrymore or specifically that's what his gestalt was or what his career was or whatever. Yeah. But you look at one close up of him and you understand that he was a star.
Yeah.
You know, you understand immediately Greta Garbo is a star. No one is lit like that who is not a star, you know?
Oh, well, that's true. The cinematography and the lighting are among the best things about it. But there's that first scene where, you know, there's like John Barrymore just sort of pats Joan Crawford on the ass with like impunity, like that would never happen today. But it's a great little moment. And she's like,
oh,
delighted.
It would never happen today. It absolutely happens today all the time. We're
not
just
in the movie.
Noticing. Well, not, you know, we're noticing it and we're calling it out. But oh, yeah, it still happens. And, you know, I was just I'm in Portugal now and my 15-year-old niece was here. And we were on the metro and this guy kind of pinched her butt, you know, and I mean, it was kind of like, did he, didn't he? Like, and it was like, yeah, he kind of did. And, you know, I mean, she laughed about it and it wasn't, you know, it didn't, I mean, but it's, this is still going on today. This kind of, these gender things are still happening.
Well, what is still happening and is so great in Grand Hotel is the moment where, you know, Wallace Beery lets her know what he wants from her. He's basically turning her into a prostitute, and she makes a decision to become a sex worker, essentially, in the movie.
Yeah.
And it's such a great little scene. She's filing her nails or something, and he says, "Are you going to be nice to me?" And she's like, "Yes."
Yeah, and it's a very pragmatic decision that I love that. At a time when, you know, we think of film as being so straight-laced in a lot of ways, and it was pre-code, but still, it was, you know, it was not an era that we think of as sort of wild and free, but here she was completely poor, not having enough money to, like, feed herself, and she's making a pragmatic decision that this is a better way to make some money, that she'll make better money, that, and it's just, it's like, it's a decision. It's not an emotionally prolonged kind of, oh, sob story kind of thing. She's just like, okay, I'll do that.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. But anyway, I was going to ask you to tell me. So let's start with this silent era. What do you think is her best silent film?
Well, I'm always, it's always hard for me to go the best, you know, I mean, yeah. I love Our Dancing Daughters, obviously. I think that a movie called The Unknown that she did with Lon Chaney, you see the beginnings of, oh, this girl's got something. And it's her first year of making movies. And she's really just learning how. You know, I think it's 26, could be 27. I'm not sure. But she plays, you know, this, she's in a knife act in a circus, and, you really see her realizing how to be still on camera and how to let the camera push in. And I mean, it's the beginnings of what will become her kind of love affair with the camera, where she can be absolutely still and you just feel all of these things, you know, looking into her giant eyes. So that's really one of my favorites of that era. In the 30s, I really love Possessed. She did two movies called Possessed. The one that from 1931 is with Clark Gable, where she's his mistress, and just very kind of matter of fact about it. And, you know, then it takes a melodramatic turn at the end, but they're so matter of fact about their relationship that in England, the movie was banned. I mean, they had to change the story so much that by the time it was shown in England, they kind of had figured, well, they were lying about not being married and actually were married. And you're just kind of, but they really kind of did that. And then, of course, I love The Women, you know, which is the end of the 30s, which, you know, where she plays the bitch kind of for the first time.
But you don't like the fashion show, which I think is cool that there's a fashion show in the middle of the movie.
I mean, the fashion show is kind of dead weight for me. I mean, I
love
it's
in color.
It's in color. But it's also like all of the action of the movie stops for 7 minutes while we watch this parade of fashions from 1939. I mean, I think it's really noteworthy that the women was 1939 was this banner year with Gone with the Wind and, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and The Wizard of Oz and all these movies. The women was the 10th highest grossing movie of the year. I mean, it was in the top 10 and against all of this competition. In the 40s, I love humoresque. I love humoresque. And of course, you know, Mildred Pierce is iconic. And the 50s for me, oh my God, Sudden Fear. I think Sudden Fear is a wonderful, wonderful movie. And okay. And also Autumn Leaves, which got a lot of
a tender movie.
Negative attention at the time. I mean, they thought it was so, oh my God, she is 15 years older than him, you know, with Cliff Robertson.
Yeah.
And then, you know, in the 60s, you really round it out with Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, where she's marvelous.
One of her great pictures, really.
Yeah.
Well, those are all great movies. The Unknown, you know, that's such a twisted movie. It's one of the most twisted movies ever made.
Well, you know, talk about what modern theater goers, moviegoers wouldn't know. Lon Chaney was just this bizarre phenomenon of the teens and 20s. And he was so physically able to contort himself. And he plays this character who supposedly has no arms. And he lights a cigarette with his feet. He drinks with his feet. He did all of this stuff with his actual arms, you know, completely tied and trussed behind him and very painfully. And I mean, the story itself is just insane. You know, it's Todd Browning, the one who did Freaks.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the idea is that he falls in love with Joan Crawford, but she has a fear of men's arms. You know, a pathological fear of men's arms, and she loves him because he has no arms. And so, but in truth, he does have arms, and he's been lying about this the whole time, but he has his arms amputated. And then he goes to only to find her. She got over her arm problem and she's with the strong man and they're like going to get married. Yay. And so he cut off his arms for no reason. And,
that's like, I mean, a Twilight Zone twisted. Right there. Yeah.
Very twisted.
Yeah. You point out in your book, and that book again is called Starring Joan Crawford, the films, the fantasy, and the modern relevance of a silver screen icon, Samuel Garza Bernstein. You point out in your book that, you know, talking pictures is not really an outgrowth of silent pictures, but that those two medium are two completely different art forms. A handful, but not very many people made the transition so successfully as Joan Crawford did. She was just as good in silent pictures as she was in talking pictures, and just as popular.
Well, you know, part of it is luck. Like, she didn't like the sound of her voice in film. She said, oh my God, I sound like a man. But her voice matched what the audience imagined she would sound like. The same was true for Garbo. You know, when Garbo, Garbo's first line was, give me a whiskey, baby, and don't be stingy. And, you know, she said that in a movie, and she's, you know, give me a whiskey and don't be stingy, you know, and the audience was like, yeah, that's her.
That's
like exactly who they imagined she was. And so that's kind of luck. But in a lot of ways, Joan made her own luck. You know, she made sure that the dice were going to roll in her favor by working as hard as she did. So she did, you know, work on her voice, and she did work on her ability to be on camera. And when when a particular cameraman early on said, look, I see your face. I understand your face. You have a remarkable face. If you lose about 15 or 20 pounds, your face is going to photograph better than anyone else's. And she said, okay. And she lost, 15 pounds, in 10 minutes, as you can do when you're 20 years old. And and it did. It made the light kind of sculpt the bones of her face in a way that was really extraordinary. And so in her telling, she was very lucky that she had a face that was built like that. That's just luck. But it wasn't luck that she went and she did what she needed to do to make it work the best possible way it could.
So speaking of what she did to become a star, there was a lot of talk about her having possibly made what we would call stag films, I guess, would the polite way of putting it, or that she slept her way to the top or any of those things. In your research, what did you find?
I find that it's very hard to, in fact, prove that someone had sex with someone else 100 years ago. The way that I look at it is, it seems clear that Joan Crawford enjoyed sex and that she enjoyed it in a way that was typical of a man rather than typical of a woman in her era. Now, for me, I think that's fantastic. Great. We should all enjoy sex as much as we possibly can enjoy sex. I don't think of that as a value judgment. Now, the idea of sleeping your way to the top is absurd. And it's not absurd because somebody wouldn't do it. It's absurd because it doesn't work. You can sleep with all the people that you want to sleep with. If the audience doesn't turn you into a star, then you're not going to be a star. And God knows all of the women that Daryl F. Zanuck tried to make into stars that were his mistress, Century Fox, yeah. None of whom were able to become stars. Like Bella Darvey and, all those women who were just like sucking all the energy out of the room when they were on screen. If Joan slept with some people here or there that were helpful to her career, possibly. Was that the deciding factor of why she became the star that she became? Absolutely not. That's insane. No one is going to bet the farm on someone just because they're good in bed. That doesn't translate into millions of people buying tickets around the world. And, she was the number one box office draw at the beginning of the top of the talkie era in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that actually accounts for some of the more peculiar films that she made. I was reading a book about Clara Bow, and mm-hmm. the author was saying that because Clara Bow was such a box office draw in the 1920s, Paramount did not want to waste good pictures on her because people would go to see her no matter what picture she was in. So they
why
put her
bother?
In
why bother? Yeah.
So I think that's might have played into MGM's way of thinking when they put her in, Ice Follies of 1937 or whatever it's called.
1939. There's no reason. See, here's the thing. It's very easy to look back and go, oh my God, what were these people thinking? But when you look at Ice Follies of 1939, which is a dreadful movie, I am not in any way trying to say it is not a dreadful movie.
Jimmy Stewart sings it.
Jimmy Stewart. Well, and it's an ice skating movie where none of the four stars can ice skate. But, it's got a glossy color sequence. It's got all of this ice dancing. On paper, it could have been a big hit. It just wasn't because it didn't gel. The chemistry wasn't there. The chemistry wasn't there between Jimmy Stewart and Joan Crawford. you know, there were a lot of things that just didn't work. But, you know, that's in hindsight. When you're putting it together on paper and you're kind of going, well, we can do this ice thing. We can do the queen of the movies. We can do this big new star, Jimmy Stewart. It'll be great. And, you know, and you know, you're at the breakfast meeting talking about this is what we're going to do. And it seems like a good idea. It just didn't work. And, you know, it wasn't. I do think that, but to go to your original point about, you know, they don't have to give her the great material. I think a couple of ways about that. I think her movies from the 30s that were her big hits are better than people remember them. You know, movies like Forsaking All Others and Love on the Run and, you know, which you just hear the title.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, okay, I'm pretty sure this is going to be like a screwball comedy, Love on the Run. Yeah. And it really, these movies were popular. They were well put together. They were not, you know, aiming for high art, and they did not achieve high art. But what they did achieve was, in the Depression, making millions and millions and millions of people sort of forget their troubles. And, you know, that's valuable too. It doesn't mm-hmm. all have to be Norma Shearer playing Marie Antoinette.
In fact, none of it needs to be Marie Antoinette with Norma Shearer.
Well, I would agree with that.
Well, but one of my favorite, there are some just like incredibly bad things that are fun. I think it's the Hollywood Review of 1929 is what it's called, where she makes her first talking appearance and she sings a song. And these guys come and they carry her across to the piano or something. And her head is no longer seen. She, like, they lift her up. And why
yeah,
they didn't
they well, cut just, her head off.
Why don't they do another take? No, they can't afford another take at MGM.
Now I'm not entirely certain, to be fair.
Yeah.
The way that prints have been saved or not saved and how they've been recut to fit other formats.
Well, it could it be that her head possible. Was not cut off.
Yeah, it is possible that in 1929, everyone could still see her head. I don't
Although
know.
Although no one else's head is cut off in any
no
other
No one sense. Else's head is cut off. I'm just allowing for the possibility. you know, look, when they started making talkies, really, they all looked terrible. They all looked like they were on stage. The camera didn't move. You know, you saw kind of a proscenium stage. And oh my God, the timing of them. You know, you would say, like, someone would open the door and say, hello, and then clop, 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 walking through the room. And then they would say something else. And, you know, because they got to the other microphone. And, you know, they were really, movies were kind of terrible for a couple of years in there. And then they found their way. You know, they rediscovered the art form for how to do this with sound. Because by the end of the silent era, they were doing amazing things with cinematography. But they kind of went back to square one when sound came in, because the limitations of the technology were just so, so extreme for a while. You know, and then they quickly started to figure it out. And they really did very quickly, very quickly.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons I like Grand Hotel, because I think it's one of the first talking pictures that is as good as a silent picture.
I would agree.
An interesting thing about silent films is that silent films were never silent, because there was always music. Sometimes an orchestra would be playing. Whereas early talking pictures, you mentioned Todd Browning, who did The Unknown, his Dracula was one of the first talking pictures, and it is really silent. Like, there's long sequences where there's no sound whatsoever. There's no score.
They hadn't discovered Foley yet. Like, they hadn't discovered, like, filling with all the sound that you'd be hearing around you. They just hadn't thought of it. You know, I mean, it was really just they hadn't thought of it yet. Yeah.
They thought if you put a score under it, people would wonder where the music is coming from. Mm-hmm. And in Grand Hotel, there's a lot of music, but they explain that the music is coming from the orchestra that's playing in a room, you know, where the dancing is.
It's like a musical. It's like the kind of show business musicals where all the musical numbers are part of a show.
Yeah,
like
that's
somebody's
right.
singing in character.
It breaks into song.
Yeah, it's like that. So the music is from the lounge or the other room or the restaurant or whatever.
Yeah. I think it's King Kong. Maybe is one of the first films that has a score underneath to sort of heighten the excitement of it, and it works a lot. And
I mean, they really. You also have to remember that in those early 30s, in those years, a huge proportion of theaters in America were still showing silent movies. It was incredibly expensive to upgrade. So Our Dancing Daughters was playing in theaters in 1934.
Wow, really?
Six years later, there were still theaters. They were independent theaters, but in places where they were still showing silent movies.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize it went on that long. But she made other films that she made after Our Dancing Daughters, the silent films that have similar titles, which now I can't remember. Our
Modern Maidens and Our Blushing Brides.
Right. Now, are they sequels or not sequels? They're just in the, they just
they're not. Same. They're not. And in fact, Our Blushing Brides is really. Oh gosh. I'm embarrassed. I might be confusing Our Modern Maidens and Our Blushing Brides. I do get them confused, but one of them is very downcast with like a suicide and like, it's like, wow, we have left the jazz baby behind. but they're generally about young women trying to make their way in the world. And whether that means finding the guy they want to marry or, finding a career. There's that magic of three girls, three coins in a fountain, How to Marry a Millionaire. It's like, it's the three girls. And, but by the end, Joan Crawford was the girl, she was, name above the title and, well on her way.
We're talking with Samuel Garza Bernstein, and he's just written a book called Starring Joan Crawford. In addition to, Doctor Strange and the Scarlet Witch.
The Multiverse of Madness.
how many times did Joan Crawford and Clark Gable appear in together in pictures?
They made 8 films together. And the last one was Strange Cargo. And it's actually what gave me the idea for the Doctor Strange thing. Because... Clark Gable was clearly the lead. I mean, he was clearly the lead of that movie. But Joan got first billing on the title cards. What they did is they both had it in their contract that they get top billing. So MGM went to Joan and said, "Well, you'll let Clark, take top billing, right? Because he's got the bigger role." And she said, "Yeah, absolutely not." Oh, I love Clark. Yeah, Clark. I love Clark. No, and so the compromise they came up with is that in the poster art, one of them was in top billing, and that on the screen when the movie played, the other one was top billing, and which okay, that's fair. But she was not the lead, but she was top billing. And I thought that was really fun, the idea of Joan Crawford and Clark Gable in Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness, where she would be playing, Maximo, the character that Elizabeth Olsen plays.
Yes.
Yeah. WandaVision. Yeah. And actually to take the idea further, so that would be in her era when she was in her late 20s and early 30s. Well, in the 40s, I imagined her if she were, in her 40s at Warner Brothers, but doing it now, I imagined her doing the eyes of Tammy Faye. Like that would have been Joan Crawford.
Hard for her.
Or in the 50s when she was doing those roles, I could imagine her playing the Meryl Streep role in Don't Look Up as President of the United States. Yeah. And my favorite, very silly imagining is that in the 60s, she'd be doing a Ryan Murphy television series with Betty Davis, where they play co-joined twins in Freaks Squared. And
I want to see that.
And I would like to see that too. And we did my amazing artist who came up with those, Debbie Moses Ferrari, did these wonderful posters for all of those movies. And they're there in color. There's 32 pages of color in this book. And I have to say, the publisher, I cannot believe the quality level that they decided to invest. You know, we have 140 pages of black and white photography, 32 pages of color, and the quality level is just amazing.
It really
I'm
is.
So
and there's
happy.
lots of well-written text as well.
Well,
and
thank you.
Sometimes opinionated, which is appropriate for this particular book.
Well, I think if you're not going to have an opinion about these things that have been written about a lot, you know, this is, I am not mining new territory here in terms of writing about Joan Crawford. There are lots of books about Joan Crawford, but they're not really looking at her work or her public persona. They're looking at, you know, a standard biography. And I think over the years, it's become, you know, very normal and fashionable to kind of denigrate her work as if she was just this sort of movie star that was manufactured. And I don't find that to be the case at all. I think she was very vital on screen. Look, she wasn't Meryl Streep. I'm not going to make, you know, an argument that she was capable of that kind of versatility. But she was magnetic on screen, and she mattered to the audience. She mattered to the audience for 50 years. And I wanted to look at, well, why? You know, why? Why her? And hopefully the book explores, you know, some of the reasons for why that may be.
Well, I mean, her range is pretty wide for someone in that era. You know,
absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
Except for Betty Davis, there really isn't anybody who's comparable.
Well, and Betty Davis was a very different kind of actress, and a very different kind of screen star. Her audience wanted some of the sort of, you know, the far sort of ranges that she would go in her characters. I don't think they wanted that of Joan Crawford. And the few times that she tried to do that, I think she was effective. Look, she did a movie called A Woman's Face, where she played a criminal with a disfigured face that, you know, is her face is corrected by a plastic surgeon. And but then the question is, can her life be put together? I think it's a remarkable movie that George Cukor directed. It did not make money. It was not successful. And even some of her terrible movies at MGM were successful.
Right.
A Woman's Face was not what her audience wanted to see her do.
Well, of course, Betty Davis is attractive, but Joan Crawford is beautiful. There's just
no... Yeah, Joan, I mean, you look at, and it's very interesting, you know, at the beginning of Mommy Dearest, Faye Dunaway is playing Ice Follies of 1939, and she looks like a drag queen. And you look at what Joan actually looked like in that movie, she was at her most beautiful. She was soft and beautiful and just almost like kind of luscious. And a really far cry from, you know, the drag queen of Faye Dunaway's Mommy Dearest performance. And, you know, you kind of see this caricature that that people kind of started imagining, you know, what she was. And it really wasn't the sum total of her work at all.
Mommy Dearest is the only film I can think of that destroyed the careers of two actresses. One...
Yeah.
Joan Crawford, who was no longer living, and the other, Faye Dunaway, who up until that point was a fine actress and did some great work, and after that has never done anything of note.
Well, I think from what I understand, Faye Dunaway was not an easy person to work with, and that Mommy Dearest was the occasion because of, you know, it not having the reception that people hoped for. It was just kind of, okay, we can just stop this with her because she's not worth it. I think Faye Dunaway would have weathered Mommy Dearest if she hadn't been quite as difficult to work with. And I mean, you know, Betty Davis called her a nightmare to work with. If, you know, if Betty Davis is saying you're too difficult, I think you kind of have to think about your life choices. You know, that's
when the book Mommy Dearest came out, Betty Davis expressed regret for Joan Crawford and said, you know, it's just a terrible thing that had happened. And,
yeah,
you know, I don't believe that this is true. And what a horrible thing to have your children do this to you. And then when Betty Davis died, her daughter wrote a very similar, terrible book about her.
Yeah, she did. And I do want to stress that I in no way want to imply that, you know, that Joan Crawford was a great mom to Christina Crawford. I don't believe, I mean, whatever is heightened or remembered perhaps incorrectly in Mommy Dearest, I think is no different than how we all remember our childhoods. We all, like, if you look at three siblings, the younger siblings of Joan Crawford all remember her very well and thought she was a wonderful mother. And I think both things can be true, and that you can really remember things. First of all, when we're remembering our childhoods, we're always the star of the story, you know, because it was happening to us.
Right,
and we
right.
don't, and the younger we are, we don't understand all that's going on around us. And we don't understand that our parents make decisions that aren't just about us, that are about a million things. And so I think we look at it in a way that makes it into, just a story that is heightened. I'll just say it's heightened. I have no interest in denigrating Christina Crawford, but I do have an interest in saying that even if every single bit of the book Mommy Dearest is completely factual, that is not all that Joan Crawford should be remembered for when she had this remarkable 50-year career and really created some of the bones for what modern American women thought they should be. She really was that important in her day. And, you know, who we think of as, you know, the woman who can juggle everything and have it all and everything, that was Joan Crawford. She was the one saying you could do that.
I agree. I also think there's a double standard. That is, you know, we don't look at the life of Pablo Picasso and say, well, what a horrible guy he was. Let's never look at his paintings again.
I agree. There is a double standard. Women are judged far more harshly for making choices that are deemed as selfish, in quotation marks. Nobody asks a man how he juggles his work and fatherhood.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, and everyone asks every, you know, famous woman, how do you juggle motherhood with your career? You know, you've got that double standard right there.
Well, I'm sure she said, as long as there's no wire hangers, everything will be fine. What was her relationship with Clark Gable off screen?
Well, they certainly had a sexual relationship. They had a romantic relationship. Their friendship and their relationship lasted over a period of a number of years. And they were kind of there for each other at bad moments for the other, you know, the other person. I don't think she was romantically involved with him after Carol Lombard's untimely death when she was killed in a plane crash on a war bond tour. But Joan was certainly there for Clark in a major way when he kind of fell apart. So it wasn't just a romantic thing, but you know, they were, as I think both of them in different words and in different ways, they were kind of the same person. And as such, in male-female terms of the 1930s and 1940s, the same people couldn't get married because, you know, there was only room for one of you to be that person. And, you know, and they couldn't have done it together in their view, I think.
Well, I really love the book, and there's a lot in it, and it's an original take on the old sort of films of kind of idea of you know, the films of whoever they used to make those books. And I really, really appreciated the book. It's called Starring Joan Crawford: The Films, the Fantasy, and the Modern Relevance of a Silver Screen Icon, and the author, my guest, Samuel Garza Bernstein. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I had the best time. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.